Arthur crystallized pepsin in 1930 and trypsin in 1932, so that by the time I was at Columbia, the fact that enzymes or proteins was well established, and I must have known that at that time when I was when I gave the seminar on fermentation. Incidentally, just as some reflection on my own thinking at the time, I didn't know I was going to get a job at the University of Chicago, of course, and had to worry about what I was going to do the next year. And I had applied to the National Research Council for renewal of the fellowship, which I might very well not have received, to work at Harvard with Edwin Cohn, who was then concerned with the basic physical chemistry of amino acids and proteins. In particular, and this bears on my later life, John Kirkwood was in Cohn's, was a collaborator with Cohn. He wasn't in Cohn's laboratory, he was at MIT, but wrote papers on the activity coefficients of amino acids and proteins, and explained the enormous changes in solubility of proteins with added salts on the basis of the changes in the activity coefficients. And that was, on the one hand, an extension of the Debye-Hickel activity coefficient concepts to siderine, and on the other hand, could be regarded as an application of physical chemistry to biochemistry. It was that work in Cohn's laboratory that interested me and that caused me to apply. Cohn accepted me, subject to my getting the fellowship, which Lord knows if I ever would have received, but in the meantime I had the opportunity to go to Chicago. That's an interesting story too, although really irrelevant to the history of
this story. It's a story I want to know. Okay.
No, you do want to?
I want to know, yes.
I say. Well, I was doing this work at Columbia. Incidentally, the name of the professor of organic chemistry there was Bogert.
Yes. Marston Bogert.
Marston T. Bogert.
Yes. Who never in his life, I think, completed a organic chemistry course. Do you know that story?
No.
I'll have to tell you that.
Okay. But Marston, well, anyway, I was at Columbia working on the mechanism, kinetics and mechanism of the benzylic acid rearrangement. And at that time, Karash had published a paper on the quote peroxide effect, unquote, on the Cannizzaro reaction. He had found that the Cannizzaro reaction of benzaldehyde was greatly accelerated by atmospheric oxygen and could be not prevented but greatly diminished in rate by using strict anaerobic conditions. Now, it turned out later that that was not a peroxide effect in the usual Karash sense. What happened was that oxygen caused the autooxidation of some benzaldehyde, and that formed sodium benzoate. Sodium benzoate is a poor emulsifying agent, but much better than none. It was a heterogeneous reaction he was studying, and the emulsification increased the rate. Well, that turned up much later. Much later. Time we didn't know anything about it. I was a great admirer of the work of Karosh and Mayo, which had been published by then.
It was already out.
It was already out. It had come out about 1934 or 5. It was out by the time I was a graduate, finishing my graduate work at Harvard. Mm-hmm. And of course I knew that work. It was greatly interested. And since I didn't understand the peroxide effect on the Cannizzaro reaction, and since I worried, and since I thought the benzylic acid rearrangement was something like the Cannizzaro, I tested the benzylic acid rearrangement, which I was carrying out in homogeneous solution, for the same kind of oxygen effect that Karosh had observed at the Cannizzaro. Quite naturally, there wasn't any effect. Well, Karosh was looking for a staff member for the University of Chicago, and he came to Columbia on his tour, and among other things, he asked Bogert whether there might not be a National Research Council fellow there. Bogert said, absolutely not. And according to Karosh, essentially refused to let Karosh see anyone but his, Bogert's, own students. And
it wasn't out of ignorance that he said this.
It may have been out of ignorance. Okay. I don't know. Okay. But he was concentrating on his own students.
Sure.
And this infuriated Karosh so much that Karosh asked the question elsewhere and found out there was one and came and found me, working away in the laboratory. He wanted to know what I was doing, and I explained it. And of course, I explained to him how I had just done this test for the peroxide effect on the benzoic acid rearrangement, and found none. At the time, I was very much concerned that telling Karosh that I couldn't find this effect was going to turn him off.
Right.
But of course, with the better perspective one gets with years, I realized that that's why I got my job. That I had, the fact that I had read his paper, thought it was important, and acted upon it, was, I am sure, the greatest possible recommendation for me as a really far-seeing, bright, alert young man. And, I'm convinced that that's how I got my start. It's just, one of the foolish, in a way, breaks. A break. I'd applied for other absolutely terrible jobs and been turned down out of hand by people who didn't consider me at all. I was considered at the time at Cornell. I went there and gave a seminar. And my competitor was Bill Miller, who does fluorine chemistry. And they picked him instead of me. And in retrospect, I think I have had a better career than he has. But I don't think that was a foolish choice in any way. Bill Miller obviously was working in an interesting and expanding field of organofluorine compounds, and he's done very well with it and made real contributions to the field. So I think he was both a good man and a good field. I have no feeling that if I had been in their place, I wouldn't have made the same decision.
So there wasn't any problem with Hammett raised this instance. He said that a number of his graduate students through the 30s were Jewish and had difficult times in placing them. Most of them ended up doing relatively well. I think I noticed you have I think Trepper's name down.
Drucker certainly isn't Jewish.
Was it Flexner? Maybe Flexner.
Flexner.
One of the mm-hmm. two had mm-hmm. difficulty. And others. And he came out later. He said there was definitely an anti-Semitic attitude in the area of chemistry, and it didn't really pass until after the war. And then...
That is entirely true. There's no question about that. And University of Chicago, Stieglitz was Jewish and Karas was Jewish. And it may be that they were less prejudiced. And Schlesinger was not Jewish, but but maybe had a little bit of Jewish connection. I may have been very lucky in getting that, but I have no feeling whatsoever that the decision at Cornell, which was the only other decent job I had any shot at, had anything to do with anti-Semitism. I think that was made strictly on the basis of people looking at the listening to the two seminars and deciding which was the better. As I said, I think if I had listened to them, I might have made the same decision they did. But I think there was. There was some anti-Semitism. I personally faced relatively little anti-Semitism.
When you were at Columbia, did you spend much time talking to Hammett?
I spoke to Hammett a fair amount. There was this group of people whose names I wrote down that formed a little nucleus of people who talked together a good deal, went out to lunch together almost mm-hmm. every day, had dinner together. Not infrequently. A couple of us may have had dinner together once a week or twice a week. Mm-hmm. And the whole group might have gone out to dinner together once every 3 weeks. And we talked a great deal of science together. In fact, I don't remember talking with these people about anything very much else except science. This was in the middle of the Depression, and it could have been highly political. Mm-hmm. And some of these people were fairly political. I was extraordinarily apolitical at the time. Mm-hmm. I wasn't anywhere near as concerned with the politics of the world as it seems to me in retrospect I ought to have been. If the word ought has any meaning.
One of my questions later on was going to be, did the social political climate ever of that period have any impact on your science? And apparently it did not.
No, but it was there.
Okay.
Well, anyway, let me give the list.
Please
of people,
do.
This is a good list of people.
Important. Yes.
First and foremost was Pete Treffers, whose real name is Henry. It's Henry Peter Treffers, but that was Pete Treffers, and I don't know where he is now. He was at Yale for a while.
He became a biochemist at the Yale Medical School. Hammett talked to me about.
Mm-hmm. He was a first-class scientist, mm-hmm. and then Joe Steigman. Martin Paul.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about him later, mm-hmm. unless he did some work with you on the the Westheimer report.
Martin and I were together three times at Columbia, at the NDRC's Explosives Research Lab in Pittsburgh.
The Brewston Laboratory.
Brewston Laboratory. Right. And then again, when he was in charge of the chemistry section of the National Research Council.
Okay, and that's why he was a consultant to that committee you were on.
Right. Irving Roberts. Irv Roberts was the Roberts of who looked at the who postulated the bromonium ion intermediates in the addition of
bromine to double bonds.
Bromine to double bonds. That's a paper by Kimball and Roberts, and I think many people today no longer quite connect with Roberts.
Okay. Yes.
But that was Irv Roberts. And then there was Joe Greenspan. Now, Treffers and Steigman and Paul were students of Hammett's. Greenspan certainly was a student of Lemaire's. And I think Roberts was too. I ought to go on back and check to see whether Roberts worked with Hammett ever. I don't know if he did.
Well, Kimball was
a physical chemist at Columbia.
Right.
But Roberts wasn't working with Kimball.
I see.
He wasn't a graduate student of Kimball.
I see. Okay.
I don't know. And then at Columbia at the time, in addition to Hammett, there was quite a constellation of stars. Lemaire was there and contributed greatly to the field, I think, of reaction kinetics.
Mm-hmm.
And Greenspan, who was a Lemaire student, was a very good kineticist and was a marvelous person with whom to discuss mechanistic problems. And a sort of Talmudic scholar type who would be glad to discuss the questions which I've described as how many chemical angels can stand on the head of a chemical pin. And although I'm rather scornful of that sort of thing, because I believe it can be so grossly overdone, there's nothing like a discussion with a Talmudic scholar to sharpen your wits.
It's a good metal exercise, no question.
And Greenspan was very, very good at that. There was a biochemist in the chemistry department there, Pop Nelson. I never learned very much about what Nelson did, but the fact that there was a biochemist in the chemistry department and that people were interested in his work, certainly,
I think Hammett had a very high regard for him.
Was not lost on me there. And Harold Urey was there, doing the various businesses of isotope separation by distillation, in particular oxygen 18 at the time. Mildred Cohn apparently was there at the time. I don't remember having met her. I bet I did, because she was with Urey at the same time I was with Hammett. And I can't remember having known her at that time. That may have to do with my crummy memory for people. But I don't know. But that was a very exciting group of people at Columbia. Mm-hmm. And I had much more stimulation with respect to physical organic chemistry there than at any other time in my life. It might have been good with Conant here if he had stayed. When he left, the atmosphere changed away from physical organic chemistry. It may have begun to revive when Paul came back, but, you know, there wasn't a group of people. And this was a group of people, all of whom were interested in physical organic chemistry, and all of whom were interested in reaction mechanisms, and it was a splendid year.
That, you know, puts Hammett's work sort of in perspective as well, because you know, there were these other people around him, and when I said, who were you talking to, he'd say no one. But I strongly suspect he was talking to these people, and just, you know, not about anything in particular, but about a lot of general things. Does that make sense?
Well, I think he talked to all these people. When he says no one, I think he's thinking that he didn't have any colleagues to talk to. It was very hard to talk to Lemaire, because I think that Lemaire was as beloved at Columbia as one of my friends at Harvard.
Hammett shared an office with him at one time, but apparently not any longer when you were there.
No. I have a nice story to tell about Hammett and me. I was trying to get my work started at Columbia. I was having a hell of a time, and I couldn't get any supplies, and I couldn't get anything done. I didn't have any money, and I didn't understand about money, and I wanted Columbia to put up a couple $100 for something or other, and I couldn't get anywhere. And I put up pretty much of a storm with Boger, who was chairman of the department. And next thing I knew, Hammett came into my lab. And he recited this business with Boger. He said that he thought that I had been really fairly rude to this distinguished colleague who was chairman of the division. Mm-hmm. Hammett's always very mild. I knew enough to know to read all those words. Mm-hmm. So I took off a lab jacket. People wore them then. Mm-hmm. And I got up and said, Professor Hammett, you're entirely wrong. I was absolutely out of line. And I am now on my way down to Professor Boger's office to apologize. He said, oh, no, don't do that.
Don't go that far.
It suddenly dawned on me that it was his duty to come and chide me, but he caught me by. I was absolutely lying.
Do you remember an accident that you had when you were at Columbia? Do you ever remember burning your nose?
Oh, yes, of course.
Hammett told me that story off the record.
Well, Gene will tell you that story.
Oh, okay.
Two, because
he thought it was funny because apparently he had to fill out some kind of form. You had to go to the infirmary, and he had to fill out an accident form or something of some sort. And one of the questions on the form was, you know, was the person to whom the accident occurred at fault? And he wrote back and said, absolutely, he was at fault. Okay. Somehow or other, I didn't know you were there, and later on it came out, and he just remembered that. Mm-hmm. That was very funny.
That was a very good year at Columbia. I was miserably unhappy socially. I had an apartment a few blocks away. I worked day and night. All year long. I don't know why I said miserably unhappy socially. I went to a lot of theater in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Cost 85 cents in those days for standing room. And since there no one sat in the theater, because no one had bought any seats, after you step through the first scene of the first act, the ushers practically pushed you into the seat so there'd be someone for the players to play to. And, but I was, it was a hard, slogging year, but scientifically it was great. Absolutely great. You had all these people to talk to. And during that year, I did all that reading on biochemistry. Now, what set me off to do that, I'm not quite sure. I certainly knew about the existence of enzymes as proteins. I knew about Stanley's tobacco-mosaic virus essentially as soon as it was done. When I started my program of working out the mechanism of enzyme action, because I was decided that it must be acid-base catalysis by those groups on protein. And so it is, you know. Only what I did was turned out not to work. The amino acids turned out by themselves not to have any effects any larger than those you'd expect for the acid and base groups that were there. Now, many years later, Gardner Swain and a Brown, I don't know what Brown it was, but this, I think, famous paper of Swain and Brown, you know?
No, I don't.
Oh, Swain and Brown looked at the uterotation of tetramethyl glucose in benzene as solvent using alpha-pyridone as catalyst, and found that alpha-pyridone was a catalyst, I'm going to say 10,000 times, but we can look it up and see, more powerful than you would have expected from a combination of an equally weak acid and an equally weak base present in reasonable concentrations. Now, of course, since this, the acid plus base reaction with tetramethyl glucose would be third order, whereas alpha-pyridone and tetramethyl glucose is second order, you have to state at what concentration level you are operating. But it was something like 10,000 times greater at concentrations of something like 0.05 molar, which is a very high concentration when you consider it.
Yeah.
And the ratio would become even greater at lower concentrations.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really a very good demonstration. And it was the sort of thing that I had been looking for with amino acids, with an acid and base group together. And the difference between what Swain Brown did, I didn't write this down because I forgot I was going to talk about it. I don't know when they did it, but let's say 1955, we can look up the records. And what I had done 20 years earlier was that they had the brains not to work in water. And it's, of course, water that ruins the kind of concerted catalysis that that I've been looking for. And I don't think that I was so awfully stupid not to have realized that in 1935-36. But I sure didn't. And Swain and Brown, very much later, did what I wanted to have done and failed.
It took 20 years for them to become that sophisticated. And
well, it may have. I don't know. We better look up the date on that. I don't know what the date was. It may have been earlier than that.
Okay.
It was some years later. Yes. But I don't know. But anyhow, those were the... I was certainly interested in trying to do biochemical research.
Okay. There. Before we leave the Columbia years and in that benzoic acid paper, there's a footnote where you cite Paul Bartlett. And the question I had was, were you communicating with Bartlett, or was he a referee?
He was not, to the best of my knowledge and belief, a referee. The a referee for that paper was Jack Aston at the at Penn State University, who picked up some sort of ambiguity or misdefinition or something in my chemical equations.
Mm-hmm.
And he had been one of Coleman's students or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote in a very nice and quite a complimentary referee report and pointed out this error and signed the referee report. When I was on my way from Columbia to the University of Chicago, I stopped in at Penn State to see him.
Mm-hmm.
I was fairly young. I looked much younger than I was, just extremely young. And he put me off, thinking I was